are the crowning glory of God's creation. You ever feel like the crowning glory of God's creation? You ever get up in the morning and look in the mirror and be like, hey, you are the crowning glory of God's creation? Try that tomorrow morning, just an experiment. See how this might change your day. We have so much to be grateful for. Fran Furter and John Hagel are the Catholic authors of a book called Tender Fires, The Spirituality of Sexuality. I'm going to be quoting a lot from that book tonight because they say it very well. They write, as part of the centerpiece of God's creative design, gendered humanity, male and female together, provides an image of the God who chose to dwell in flesh. Isn't it weird how sometimes Christians like put the body down when God left heaven and took on flesh? I mean, flesh is amazing, right? Sexuality is that unique and mysterious vehicle that holds the man and woman together in shared humanity. As such, it is a guardian of God's image. Its essence is sparked with divinity. It has holy intent and sacred meaning. God wants us to be sexual, to be lovers and life givers. God made us to be passionate, to be capable of feeling the fire of creation within every part of our being. It is a warm and caring God who placed within us a powerful drive to forge relationships with one another. It is a trusting God, respectful of our freedom, who allows us to discover the mystery of Eros as it unfolds in our bodies and our hearts. And it is a playful, pleasure-loving God who gave us smiles and laughter and orgasms, who gave us skin that hungers for touch, who made us desire beauty and destined us to fall in love. The fact that this important dimension of God's creation can be used selfishly does not diminish its intrinsic goodness, nor ought it to cause us to mistrust our body's gift of pleasures or our soul's delight in human love. Christopher West gives a great illustration that I just find really heartening. He says that the most beautiful picture in the world, like if he was going to paint the most beautiful picture in the world for him, it would be a picture of Adam and Eve in the garden, right? The beautiful reflection of God's image, the pinnacle of creation. And then takes a piece of paper. I will demonstrate. This is the beautiful picture, right? The fall happens, right? Everything gets broken, deformed. Many Christians say, we better throw it out. It's broken. So I'm sure some of you were raised in homes where sex was not talked about or it was considered to be like a dirty thing or a taboo topic. Well, Hugh Hefner, does everybody know who Hugh Hefner is? Playboy icon of pornography. Christopher West says, well, Hefner found it, and he said, oh, look what I found. This is good. We got it. You got to know about this. You got to taste this. You got to try this. This is awesome. And so he brought all these sexual images and all kinds of sexual acts right up under people's noses. But this is what he was offering, this crumpled thing. And theology of the body says, give me that a minute, and opens it up and restores it, takes a look at the original intent. What were we really created for? We weren't created for the fall. We were created for something beautiful. And Hugh Hefner once said that his mother came to him as when he was an adult, and she said to him, Hugh, I'm really sorry that I didn't hug you very much when you were a child. And he said to her, that's okay, Mom. I've built a whole industry out of getting people to hug me. So he recognized this need, right? He went about it in the wrong way, totally misguided, but he recognized something that the church sometimes misses. West asks, who's closer to God, the sex addict or the Pharisee, the rule keeper? Anybody want to guess? What? No, who is closer to God, the sex addict or the Pharisee? The person who keeps all the rules. Anyway, he says that it's the sex addict because the sex addict understands that he can't do it on his own, that he is empty, that he is looking for something. So anyway, I just thought that was a good story. So our bodies are intrinsically good and beautiful, and they were made for Eros. That's because we are born of the Eros of God. Eros is a Greek word that means desire, And we tend to reduce it to genital desire, but in fact, it has traditionally meant love of beauty, longing for goodness, the soul's restless hunger for God. In what ways do we observe the eros of God? Well, I find, when I look at creation, I find that it is just dripping with sexuality and sexual energy. Do any images from nature, like just raw nature, come to mind when you think of how sexuality might be revealed in creation? Anything come to mind? Palm trees. clusters of dates by any chance? Okay, any other images come to mind? Water? A flower, yes. Isn't it cool how flowers have, don't they have like both, like stamen and stigma or something, they have both sex organs in together? That's pretty cool, right? Anything else? Any other images? The one that comes to my mind is pounding waterfalls, going into these gorges. Anyway, the images are too many to number, but it's there. You look at it one time. Go for a walk in nature. I'm making you laugh. Go for a walk in nature and ask God, show me the beauty of sexuality. Show me the eros of God in this walk today, and you'll see it. And then there's our response to creation, the heart's pull toward beauty, our longing for connection with each other, our desire and our ability to create life, to reflect the sexual image of God by producing life from our own bodies. The story of God and his people is an erotic story. Listen to some of this scripture. My soul yearns, even faints for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh cry out for the living God. As the deer pants for streams of water, so my soul pants for you, my God. Do not worship any other God, for the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. I will betroth you to me forever. Yes, I will betroth you to me in righteousness and justice, in loving kindness and mercy. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord. You hear that? The love story of God and creation has all the elements of a racy romance novel, right? We've got jealousy, tenderness, passion, yearning desire, and mutual vulnerability. Ever stop to think how God makes God's self vulnerable to us? God asks us to pray, asks us, dares us to move God with our prayers. When God took on flesh, put himself at the mercy of the incarnation, right? We killed him because he made himself vulnerable to us. I try not to use male pronouns for God, but it is so hard. I'm still working on that. Christopher West writes, the Bible begins in Genesis with the marriage of the first man and woman, and it ends in Revelation with another marriage, the marriage of Christ and the church. Through this lens, we learn that God's eternal plan is to marry us, to live with us in an eternal exchange of love and communion. So the fact is, we are hardwired for love. We were made for love. The triune God is a communion of love. We are destined to share in that exchange. How we receive love from God and give love to God deeply affects how we give love to and receive love from others, and vice versa. So why does it matter? As the source of the family and life itself, the union of the sexes, writes West, is placed at the center of the great struggle between good and evil, between love and all that is opposed to love. Therefore, if we are to win the spiritual battle, the first thing St. Paul says we must do is gird our loins with the truth. Isn't that interesting? To gird our loins. Sexual justice takes this seriously. We must gird our loins and our hearts with the truth that will set us free to love. Can we start to see that our sexuality is a battleground where every victory and defeat is of significance? Remember what I said about how deep and abiding the wounds of sexual abuse are? The spiritual wounds of sexual abuse are deep and abiding, too, are the blessings of sexual justice. Furter and Hegel again write, the two common understandings of the erotic, the recreational and the romantic, are probably the most prevalent images in popular media. From billboards to film trailers, from subway advertising to the magazine racks at the checkout line in the supermarket, we are assailed with images of the physically provocative or the emotionally intriguing. But neither the recreational nor the romantic have room for the hard work required by real, close relationships. Does that sound like good news or bad news? That real relationships are hard work. Is that reassuring, or is it it's kind of a downer? It's a downer? Yeah, it'd be so nice if everything was easy, right? Intimate relationships, write Furter and Hegel, demand a level of personal investment. Now listen carefully to this. Demand a level of personal investment that stretches our imaginations and the boundaries of our generosity. Love is a crucible of human selfhood, no matter what our religious perspective. The biblical vision of intimacy is in obvious tension, if not outright contradiction, with many of the images of sexuality prevalent in our culture. Joseph Campbell writes that marriage is not a simple love affair, it's an ordeal. And the ordeal is the sacrifice of ego to a relationship in which two have become one. Okay, that doesn't really come through in the wedding magazines, does it? Or in the wedding photos, or in many wedding ceremonies. Imagination, generosity, ordeal, sacrifice, investment, stretching the boundaries, these are hallmarks of sexual justice, putting the real needs of the other before our own, a crucible of human selfhood. Is anybody signing up for crucible of human selfhood? Have any takers? That is definitely not what the world is selling, right? But while sexual justice may not look sexy by the world standards, it is in fact an invitation to a life of goodness, truth, joy, connection, creativity, and love. The main hallmark of justice in our sexual relationships is intimacy. And authentic intimacy isn't as much what we do with our bodies as it is what we do with our hearts. The demands of trust and commitment make the journey into intimacy a daunting adventure. But most of us want to make this daunting journey, don't we? Most of us want to be in love, to share our lives. But many of us have not received the emotional and spiritual resources to do so. The challenge of integrating the physical and psychological dimensions of intimacy demands a level of maturity and commitment that eludes many couples. Despite the popular use of language, having sex is not always a way to experience intimacy. In fact, in many cases, the physical performance of sex is a substitute for intimacy, or even an escape from it. Intimacy is made possible by a number of things. I'll try to take some time to define this, because I have no idea what you think of when I say the word intimate. So, the first that I'm going to talk about is self-awareness. So knowing ourselves is a skill that can be acquired through prayer and practice. Proverbs 4:5-7 says, "Get wisdom, get understanding, do not turn away from them. Do not forsake wisdom, she will protect you. Love her, she will watch over you." Get wisdom. It's a little repetitive, right? Though it cost all you have, get understanding. Must be pretty important. But how do you get wisdom? You can pray for it, like Solomon. You can ask your friends, "What areas of my life do you think need growth?" Have you ever asked your friends that? What are my blind spots? What am I missing? The people who truly love you will tell you. They will also tell you the truth about that person you're crushing on, or dating, or getting ready to marry. The people who really love you will tell you the truth. Listen to them. I'm a big fan of counseling, in addition to the counseling of the Holy Spirit. I have benefited personally from personal counseling, marriage counseling, and family counseling, and it's been a lifesaver. You guys have access to free counseling on Calvin. You know how lucky you are. You're probably going to want to access counseling at some later time in your life, and it won't be free. So I really encourage you. I hope you don't have this massive run on the counseling office, but I just heard 18% of the student body takes advantage of that offer. You got nothing to lose, guys, except your problems. It's such a blessing. I can't speak highly enough about it. Self-discipline. Sexuality is an intense and celebratory gift with the capacity to unify hearts and souls, but it is also a volatile and potentially dangerous force that can violate and hurt other people. Becoming sexually aroused or infatuated are instinctual and natural responses. But staying in love and directing our sexual feelings in responsible ways demand a lifetime of emotional and psychic discipline. I want to say a word about purity, because this word is pretty popular, especially in some circles, especially about the purity culture that influences some segments of the church. I don't think that an emphasis on purity, which seems to always focus on the females making promises to their fathers for some reason, is a helpful paradigm in our desire for sexual justice. I don't think self-discipline is forged through pledges made as children that are then defended and protected by fathers. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Self-discipline is really about character, which is forged through all kinds of struggle and choices, and ultimately, it's about freedom. Words can be so tricky because they mean different things to different people. I mean, purity is wonderful. I want to have a pure heart before God. But the word has come to symbolize purity culture for many people. Another word that people use is chastity, and that can be a good word, but it too is often misunderstood. Chastity is viewing others not as a means to our pleasure, but as ends in themselves. Chastity is not abstinence. You can be married and chaste. If I treat my husband as a whole person, I respect and honor him and love him well, then our marriage is chaste, and if he does the same to me. So chastity is not abstinence. You can be married and chaste, and you can be abstinent and unchaste, because you can treat people like trash, but you're not having sex, you're abstinent, right? Mark Lowry, who's a professor of theology at the University of Dallas, defines chastity as that virtue by which we are in control of our sexual appetite, rather than it being in control of us. I think that's a good definition. It's a positive thing, the presence of control and strength, rather than a negative thing, the absence of sex. And then self-transcendence, which is another way of saying you look beyond yourself to others. The goal of human wholeness and Christian holiness are ultimately the same, to love others in the same spirit of generosity that God loves us. So how do we love others the way God loves us? I mean, is that a little too lofty? What does that look like? My brother and my sister-in-law went to a really good premarital counselor. I love the stuff that this guy told them. One of the things he told them was that, now, after you're married, you're going to irritate each other. You're going to walk into the bathroom and you're going to see that toothpaste cap off the toothpaste and all the dry, crusty stuff that happens, you know. Or you're going to walk in, you're going to see his dirty socks on the floor. So you can say, I can't believe it. She knows I hate that. Or he knows I hate that. Or you can say, oh, my beloved is here. My beloved has passed through this room. Now, that's funny, right? It makes us laugh. But, you know, I have days where I go, all day long through my house. And I'm not a happy camper. I'm not much fun to be with. But those days where I say, yeah, he'll be gone next year. He's moving out next year. You know, my son or something. Okay, socks this time. Or, you know, just a paradigm shift, right? So try that with your roommates when you go home tonight. Oh, my roommate has been here. Another beautiful thing that this counselor told my brother and his wife-to-be was that, you know, you're going to have conflicting desires in a relationship, any relationship, right? So, for example, it's the weekend. You're trying to decide what to do. Now, there's grocery shopping to do, and there's an invitation from, you know, Aunt Susie, and there's different things are crowding, threatening to crowd out your weekend, right? And he said, now, maybe, Todd, you're going to want to, go to the mall and get a new pair of sneakers that you've been needing. And Jane, maybe you want to get to the gym and get your swimming in, right? Now, each of you can say, this is what I want. I'm going to get what I need this weekend. Or you can swap it. And Todd, you can say, Jane, now, I know you want to get your swimming in. That's really important. So I'm going to make sure that you get your swim in. And Jane, you could say, Todd, I'm going to make sure I know that getting those new sneakers, do you see what I'm saying? What would the world be like if we swapped instead of trying to extract what we want and need from our loved ones rather than saying, I'm there for you. I am fighting so that you get what you need and want. Boy, that would be beautiful, wouldn't it? in Ephesians 5, Paul writes, now this is the Message translation, which I am very fond of. I just love the paraphrase. So Ephesians 5 is a tough chapter for some people, right? But listen to this. Out of respect for Christ, be courteously reverent to one another. Wives, understand and support your husbands in ways that show your support for Christ. The husband provides leadership to his wife the way Christ does to his church. How does Christ provide leadership to his church? Not by crushing and domineering, but by cherishing. So just as the church submits to Christ as he exercises such leadership, wives, you should likewise submit to your husband's cherishing. Husbands, go all out in your love for your wives, exactly as Christ did for the church, a love marked by giving, not getting, fighting for, not extracting. Right? Christ's love makes the church whole. His words evoke her beauty. Everything he does and says is designed to bring out the best of her. That is how husbands ought to love their wives. They're really doing themselves a favor, of course, since they're already one in marriage. No one abuses his own body, does he? No, he feeds and pampers it. That's how Christ treats us, the church, since we are part of his body. And this is why a man leaves his father and mother and cherishes his wife. No longer two, they become one flesh. And of course, that doesn't mean indistinguishable people, right? They become a new family, a new unit. This is a huge mystery, and I don't pretend to understand it all. I love that Paul confesses that, because who does? Who really understands it all, right? What is clearest to me is the way Christ treats the church, and this provides a good picture of how each husband is to treat his wife, loving himself and loving her, and how each wife is to love her husband. So men, talking to the men right now. When you sign up for marriage, you're signing up for the privilege of laying down your life for your wife. The privilege of cherishing her, of loving her body as you love your own. Women, when you sign up for marriage, you're signing up for the privilege of supporting your husband, of telling him the truth, even and especially when it's difficult, of loving his body as you love your own. I imagine that most of you want to be married someday, to build a life together with someone you love and raise a family. Are you in training today? Okay, you might get married 10, 20 years from now, I don't know. Are you in training today with your roommates and your friends for marriage, for fidelity to your spouse and your Savior, and for intimacy in your closest relationships? Men, are you practicing cherishing and seeing as whole persons the women in your life? Are you practicing reverence for them? Are you good at hearing truth from the women in your life? Women, are you practicing being cherished? That's really hard for a lot of us women. We don't expect it. We don't demand it. Are you not settling for anything less than unselfish love in your relationships? Not capitulating to being used and using others? Are you practicing honoring the men in your life by speaking the truth to them? Why is it so hard to tell the truth? Why does it feel like we're dying inside when we tell the truth? I think I mentioned this last night. I mean, I've been married 25 years, and still, when I have to say a difficult truth to my husband, it's tough. I have to, you know, work. I have to prepare myself. You know, I don't want to hurt him. I don't want to embarrass myself. I don't want to show my need. You know, it takes practice. It's a lifelong journey. Those of you who, by choice or by circumstance, will not marry also want to live a life of sexual justice. A life of goodness, truth, joy, connection, creativity, and love. You will need all the same skills that married people will need, and then some. Are you in training today for celibacy, for fidelity to your community and your Savior, and for intimacy in your closest relationships? A word on singleness. Marriage and family are great goods, but they are not gods. Much of the so-called traditional models of marriage and family that Christians tout and defend today are neither traditional nor biblical, or even in human history before the Industrial Revolution, when the norm was more along the lines of multi-family tribal groupings or multi-generational households. The church is often guilty of idolizing modern Western concepts of marriage and family, and the result is that people who do not marry or have children often feel left out or like second-class citizens. In fact, the church should be a place that embraces people of all kinds. When it is true to its calling, the church is comprised, at least in part, of communities that include single and married people, children, and older folks. And whether chosen or situational, celibate people share the same hunger for belonging, intimacy, and touch. Each is called to be a life-giving and loving person. This happens best in the context of real community. You don't have to have biological children to father or mother other people, whether children or adults, right? We are all called to that life-giving role. So I'm almost through here. I just picked some images that I find reflect intimacy. All of the images that I have here, to me, portray intimacy. So I'd like you to look at these. Take them in. Sometimes intimacy is face-to-face, gazing, talking with. Sometimes it is comforting another or laughing together. Sometimes it's, I love those. Sometimes it's side by side, teamwork, sharing joys, accomplishments. It involves giving, receiving, accompanying, sharing. I love the pictures of the president and his wife. I mean, they clearly have a good relationship. I mean, no matter what your political stance is, I just love this picture. Look, they're like in a freight elevator, and she's obviously cold because she has a sleeveless dress or something, and he's giving her jacket, and they're sharing a little, you know, forehead lean. It's just a beautiful shot. And across the ages, right? In his book, The Weight of Glory, C.S. Lewis writes, "It is a serious thing to live in a society of possible, gods and goddesses, to remember that the dullest and most uninteresting person you talk to may one day be a creature which, if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship, or else a horror and a corruption such as you now meet, if at all, only in a nightmare. All day long, we are, in some degree, helping each other to one or other of these destinations. It is in the light of these overwhelming possibilities, it is with the awe and the circumspection proper to them, that we should conduct all our dealings with one another, all friendships, all loves, all play, all politics. There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. Nations, cultures, arts, civilizations, these are mortal, and their life is to ours as the life of a gnat. But it is immortals whom we joke with, work with, marry, snub, and exploit. Immortal horrors or everlasting splendors." That's deep, right? Which direction are we helping our roommate, the irritating guy in science lab, the lady at the food service? Where are we leading our brothers and sisters? In what direction? Towards glory or somewhere else? When people talk about romantic relationships, especially when they're young and just embarking on a relationship, the question for many, especially in the church, seems to be, how far can we go? Have you ever asked that? Do you remember the answer you got from your pastor, your parent, or older sibling? I have to tell you a funny story. I made this diagram just for you. when I was a freshman in college, I had a roommate named Lynn. Lynn had a twin brother, And we got talking one day about, you know, dating and stuff, and Lynn told me that her mother told her, never let a boy touch you below the neck. Lynn's mother told her twin brother, never touch a girl below the waist. Just let that sink in a minute. You want to do the math and figure out how tragic the outcome of that would be if everybody lived by that? You have a lot of wrestling, right? I mean, that sex advice is so inept on so many levels, but anyway, I just thought that was, I had fun making that diagram. So, when navigating sexual relationships, most young people will ask, how far can I go? But what if, instead of this moralistic framework, we asked, how far are you willing to go? How far are you willing to go in living the mandate of love? How far are you willing to go in rooting your daily loving in the all-encompassing communion of God? How far will you go in honest communication? Will you say that thing that's so hard to say? How much are you willing to stretch your heart in trust? How vulnerable and self-disclosing are you with your girlfriend, boyfriend, or closest friends? How far will you go in helping to create emotional and spiritual safety in your relationships? Again, I'm quoting Furter and Hegel here. The true challenge of the gospel is the depth and breadth of its promise and possibilities. The integral demands of Christian living, and they are truly demanding, as we've talked about this evening, flow much more from grace and possibility than from mere rules or restrictions. Jesus reminds us that we are to give as we have been given to, that the measure we use to share our love will, in turn, be the measure that's used for what we receive. He also promises us that God does not ration the Spirit. So the vision of Christian intimacy is rooted in abundance, not in scarcity and restriction. If we are willing to embrace this vision of relationships and its consequences, the harvest of love will be rich indeed. So, just to summarize, sexual justice demands that our sexual relationships be authentic, which, in the words of these authors, Balswick and Balswick, covenantal rather than contractual. It's a promise. It's not a contract. Gracing rather than shaming. I'm sure that some of us in this room, myself included, have been in shaming relationships. They'll kill you. Empowering rather than controlling. Intimate rather than distancing. Do we have the courage to leave relationships where we are disempowered, controlled, shamed? Do we have the courage to build relationships with others that are covenantal, gracing, and empowering, and intimate? Sexual justice demands that all our relationships be life-giving, reverent, and loving. So, my parting thoughts for you. What would happen if the church gave more space to beauty, to goodness, to the grace of sexuality, and to the relationship between sexuality and justice? If every sexual decision we made was based on real love and sacrifice for the other person, wouldn't our sexual choices always be within the will of God? And how can we encourage and empower each other to say yes to these kinds of choices? Don't you love it when a speaker comes and doesn't give you answers, they just give you questions? And that is what I have for you this evening. I just want to say that I don't think you can live a life of sexual justice without community. I am very blessed to have a motley crew, little house church of about 5 families, and we're a mess, and we're at different stages of life, and we're fumbling along, but we're doing it together, and they are willing to hash out these questions with me. So when I'm researching pornography, they're willing to talk me through it. They're willing to walk me through hard times. We are willing to speak into each other's lives and marriages and to speak the truth to each other, and that makes all the difference. In community, you can live a life of sexual justice. Apart from it, I don't think so. I don't think it's possible. So that's it. Thank you for listening. I'm just going to leave this up as food for thought. I want to pray. In closing, Lord, thank you for creating us as vibrant sexual beings with the potential to glorify you by leading abundant, life-giving lives. May the whole of our lives be an expression of worship. Thank you that your fingerprint of eros and passion and beauty is visible throughout all of creation. Help us to see your bounty, your beauty, and your love everywhere we look. I ask that you would bowl these young people over with the beauty of your creation. Speak to them loudly and in whispers as they walk through campus. Thank you that you want more for us than we could ever imagine. I pray for the young people in this room, Lord. Give them a vision of your abundance, of the joy that you desire for them as they seek to live lives of sexual justice. Empower them with your spirit, encourage them through the body of believers, and hold them in the palm of your hand. I pray for the older people in this room. Help us to have the courage to tell the truth about our own experiences, how we've lived, who we are becoming, and how you've brought about transformation in our lives. Help all of us to understand that because of who you are and your great love for us, we are forgiven, and that we can begin today to live lives of sexual justice, and that when we stumble and fall, which we will, you are right there to lift us up again, unashamed. Thank you that with you, all things are possible. Amen. Stay here in case anybody has questions. Yeah, I'll hang out if anybody needs to, but I know I just put a lot on you, right? You can handle it though, right? You're Calvin students, yes.
Yeah, on the slide right before this, I don't quite remember what the question was. So what would happen if the church gave more space to beauty? I guess I was just kind of confused. What does it mean to give more space to beauty, goodness, and grace?
That's a good question. I think that could mean all kinds of things, but I think what I had in mind was if we focused on the beauty of our created bodies, the beauty of wholeness and relationships. What did you think of the art in this presentation? It was beautiful, right? Do you ever see art like that in churches? Right? I mean, I feel like I loved picking art for this presentation. I mean, I saw the glory of God reflected in those works of art, whether sculpture or painting or photographs. So that's one thing. I mean, I know some churches have art exhibits and bring artists in. I think that's really powerful. You know, they have coffee houses and things like that. I mean, do we ever share love songs that are really beautiful and honoring in our church? Is everything about our love for God? Do we ever sing about human love in our churches? Do we honor the couples in our congregations that have been married 30, 40, 50 years? Do we bring them up front and interview them? How did you do it? What's the secret to a happy marriage? Tell us your love story. How did you meet? What was it? You know, do we celebrate wholeness and beauty? Because wholeness and beauty, it's against all odds. I mean, the world is against wholeness and beauty, okay? Relational wholeness. So it's kind of a miracle when a marriage thrives. It's possible, you know, like I said, in community. But, you know, Matt, how many years have you been married, Matt?
Seven.
Matt has a seven-year experience that is valuable, okay? I've been married 25 years. Julia, 26, right? These people are on campus. Wouldn't it be cool if you had a night where you just, well, I don't know, the man event might be something like that, but so in our churches or on our campuses, I think, is that enough? Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Those are just some ideas that come to mind now. Yeah.
What's it like having new sons, and like, are you the one that has those kinds of conversations with them? Like,
I was just telling on my husband earlier today. I really thought that with boys it was going to be his job, you know, because I thought it would be more comfortable for the boys. But my husband isn't that comfortable with it. And I'm like super comfortable. I'm like ultra comfortable. So on the one hand, I kind of wanted that precious, intimate conversation with my sons, but I was willing, you know, I was like, Pascal, you should do this. But it's interesting because our last son actually said, my husband bought this book to read with him. It's a father-son book, right? And one day he couldn't find it because like once a week he would take Jack out for a Coke or something or they'd talk about it. And Jack was just absolutely mortified. So one time I said, Jack, have you seen that book? Dad's been looking everywhere. He goes, I burned it. He put it in the wood stove. And I was like, Jack, why did you do that? You know? I said, we're just gonna have to get another one. He goes, oh no, Mom, please, Dad, it's so uncomfortable. So I ended up talking to him about stuff and we had a great conversation. I said, that's so interesting, Jack. I assumed that you would not want to talk about it because, you know, I'm a woman. And he goes, oh no, Mom, I'm really much happier to talk to you about it. And he was really open. So I wouldn't say that there's a gender specific. I think, you know, your gifts, you should, you know, I believe in leading by gifting, not by gender. So, yeah. So was that your question?
It's
an ongoing conversation. I think that we should talk to our children about sex a lot. Although at one point, my one son said to me, Mom, do we have to talk about sex every time we get in the car? You know, because you're trapped in the car. And parents are so smart about that. They're like, there's no checking out now. I've got him for 15 minutes on the way to soccer or whatever. And then I realized, oh, maybe I'm a little heavy-handed. Just because I'm thinking about it all the time doesn't mean, you know, my teenage son needs to think about it with his mother. I'm sure he's thinking about it all the time anyway, but... Yeah. So, you know, it's not like one conversation when they're 5 or 10, whatever. It's regular. And the world offers a lot of opportunity, a lot of conversation starters. Whether you're in the checkout line and you see a magazine cover, and I mean, I am so mortified by some of the stuff that is on those magazine covers. I mean, I'm not even talking about the images, some of the copy lines, you know? People magazine recently had something like, I gave a menage a trois to my husband for his birthday, and I loved it. You know, I'm just like, really? So. Yeah?
From your experience and your thoughts on this, how would you like to see sex education change?
Okay, when you say sex education, what do you mean? School, public schools? Okay, I have to say that I haven't encountered, like, I haven't actually had a personal experience with, I mean, my kids were homeschooled until sixth grade, and I think they did have some health education stuff. I don't feel very well-versed in commenting on what there is out there, but what do I think would be good sex education? I'd like to see parents go through sex education. I'd like to educate the parents. It would be awesome if the church would give real... and I mean nitty-gritty sex education. You know, lock the doors, keep the kids out, whatever, but if adults could learn to speak really genuinely, authentically about sex, then they would be much better equipped to talk to their kids. So I'd like to see it start with the parents. And then, I mean, ideally parents should talk to their kids, but suppose both people are in the household are people like my husband who feel like completely unequipped. I don't know. I still think it's best if parents talk, but I feel like if adults did the work that they need to do on their own sexuality, they would be better equipped to talk to their kids. But I'm not really answering your question. Yeah, I mean, I have some resources. Oh, I forgot to announce. I always forget to do that. I have a clipboard out front that people can sign their name, and I'll send the PowerPoint or any. I have a list of good resources. But I just think being really real about it and not being afraid. And you know what? If you are afraid and nervous, it's still better to talk about it than not to talk about it. Because your kids are going to learn about it somewhere, and most of them are learning about it from their peers. And I talked to some parents recently, and because of that talk, a woman went and talked to her eight-year-old, a second grader, who she assumed knew nothing about sex. That little girl had a thing or two to tell her mom. Things she'd seen acted out on the playground. It is almost never too early to talk to your kids. I talked to a youth ministry class today, and all of them there, any of those people here now, I think everybody's gone, but they all admitted that they don't feel equipped to have those conversations, and they all know that they're going to have to because they're going to be in youth ministry. So, you know, it's really important. I would love to see Calvin, and I mean, I was so encouraged when I learned from Julia that you have a year-long sexuality series, so you guys have lots of options, but it is optional. I think ideally Christian campuses should have a required freshman year course on sexuality to sort of get these conversations started your freshman year. I mean, it's already, you know, you're really mature by the time you're coming to college, and in some ways, 18, you've already formed a lot of your ideas about sexuality, so. Is that helpful? Yeah.
This is kind of switching gears. Mm-hmm. How would you suggest or give hope to someone who has had a unjust relationship previously and is now looking for a redeemed version of that?
With the same person?
With a different person.
Uh-huh. Well, you're asking how can people heal from wounded relationships and wounding experiences, right?
Yes.
I think counseling is a huge plus, and I recommend it to all my friends who've had traumatic experiences. And I rank trauma probably on a much lower level than most people. Like, rape is a trauma, but I think there are many, many other, you know, like, I had a really controlling boyfriend in college. It took me years. I think I was married for, like, a couple of years before I got that guy's voice out of my head. I mean, that, I couldn't believe it. First of all, I couldn't believe that I ever got into the relationship with the guy. Like, what was I thinking? It was so obvious to everybody else. Nobody liked him, but I was kind of addicted. You know, there was something unhealthy there. So, and I didn't have counseling. I have counseling now. I go to counseling regularly now. It's an amazing gift. To me, it's like, even though money is tight in our household, like I don't, if I had to choose between a haircut or my getting my a pedicure or something, like, counseling is where I'm going to put my money. I don't have a lot of luxuries, but counseling is a gift I give myself because it's just somebody neutral out there that can speak the truth in a way that, you know, you're not going to get defensive when your counselor says, "Have you thought about?" I feel like I've been going for 2.5 years, and I just can't believe the growth. So,
how would you give hope to someone who is coming to you with that?
Give hope? Well, I mean,
I'm trying to, I guess, like, the nitty-grittiness of that kind of a trauma, of that wound,
mm-hmm.
Is there any sort of definite hope?
Or yes. I guess it really depends on the person. You know, you have to reach out for healing. You can offer hope saying, healing is possible. We serve a God of restoration. God wants to heal. I mean, God is in the healing business, right? And help is available through counseling. You have to learn new ways of doing things. And people do it all the time. I mean, you're here in college, right? You're learning new tools. You're learning to do things differently than you've done before. You're taking a new class. I mean, our brains are plastic, and they do respond. You know, if I lift weights for 60 days, my arm's going to change, you know? It's the same thing emotionally and in our relationships. You have to practice. I mean, I had to practice honesty with my husband. And I would say about 7 years ago, we went through a crisis period where we found that we were just sort of coasting. And we were like, we got scared. We got scared because we were sort of living parallel lives. But it was painful, but it was good because we're like, oh, we got to do something about this. And we started learning new ways of communicating. We sought counseling. We practiced saying hard things for each other. We practiced listening to ourselves, like, what is it that I really want? You know, you never stop learning. So, I mean, I don't know how, if your friends, how deep her trauma was, but whether it was extremely deep or your run-of-the-mill, everyday kind of trauma, you can get help. So I would just definitely don't do it alone. You can't do it alone. So seek help, seek community, seek a support group, seek, you know, counseling. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I am, you know, I'm big. I have tons of hope. Yeah, I've seen lives change. I've seen marriages be saved. I've seen broken homes, you know. I mean, it doesn't always happen that the divorced couple gets back together, but healing is possible. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just because you feel hopeless one day doesn't mean there is no hope. Our feelings are changeable.
Yeah, you had the question on one of the slides that was like the how far are you willing to go, and then the other question, I don't remember what it was off the top of my head. But with the second question, I think it was like how far can we go versus how far are you?
Yeah, how far can we go? I mean, people usually mean like, you know, can we get to first base? Can we get to second base? You know,
right.
It's kind of, yeah.
And the second question was like,
how far are you willing to go?
So like, if you have, I guess I don't really know how to phrase this. If you have like, I mean, is willingness like enough? Because willingness can change, you know?
I guess I don't really understand what you're asking.
If someone says that they're willing to, you know, do X, Y, and Z right now, and then, you know, they go down the line, they end up, like, breaking up, you know? Or they're like, you know, we're willing to do this because we have a long-term commitment to each other. We think we're going to get married, whatever, and then they don't.
Okay. Well, actually, I wasn't talking about physical stuff at all in that. I was just asking people to shift their minds.
Sure.
Because we usually are like, how much can I get out of this relationship? How far can we push the boundaries? But we never say, how far am I willing to go to love this person well? And if you think about it, what is good? So suppose you've got a girlfriend, right? I don't know what your situation is, but if you've got a girlfriend, what if you ask yourself, what is the best thing for her? Like, what will make her feel safe, protected, loved, honored? You'll probably get a very different answer than if you say, what do I feel like doing tonight, you know? And if you don't know, I mean, one of the reasons that sex is ideally better in the context of a covenant relationship, I mean, that's a broad term, but marriage is the best, you know, I think, is because when sex is introduced to a relationship, it often short-circuits the other attempts to ways of finding intimacy. You know, when you start having sex, that, you know, that's intense, right? And it often goes very quickly to that, whereas before you might have been practicing friendship, you know? Like, what is it like to me to listen to my girlfriend when she's had a hard day and she goes into tons of detail and I'm tired, you know? Like, okay, I really want to listen and ask questions so that I understand what she's getting at. Is she just rattling off a lot of details from her day, or does she just need to feel heard, you know? But if you're just like, oh, this was a hard day, you know, let's do something physical. I don't know, do you see what I mean? It's just, there's all different kinds. There's emotional intimacy, there's intellectual intimacy. There's, let's see, I heard spice, S-P-I-C-E. Emotional, spiritual. Anyway, I can't remember what they all stand for, but there are different kinds. And you know, in marriage, even when you have a legitimate sexual relationship, there's still times of abstinence. And celibacy, you know, the final months of pregnancy are sometimes like, please, I'm not, you know, I can't do that. But for some people, not all. Sometimes there's periods of sickness. You know, you have to, if you don't have anything else in your relationship except that way of connecting, even in a marriage, it can be rough. You know, you have to practice all of those to have to be truly intimate. And the more emotionally intimate you are with somebody, the better the sex is. Which is why I say that sex gets better as you get older. If you have a real growing intimate relationship. I mean, I don't know if this is TMI, but I would never go back to the sex I had our first year of marriage. Like, I'm really loving it, year 25. You know? I totally trust him. he looks at me differently than he used to. He has grown as a person. He has a lover's heart. Where when he was 25, it was like, he loved me, but he just wasn't mature enough. And I can remember little milestones in our relationship where I could tell something shifted for him. It became more and more spiritual experience for him. And the more spiritual it became for him, the more physically satisfying it became for me, which is really interesting, right? Because I could trust him more and, Sorry if I... That is my plug for married sex. it's funny. I've had the experience every once in a while. Like, sometimes people see our little house church, and like I said, we are totally a motley crew. We do not have it together, but we're real. We're authentic. And every once in a while, somebody will come and say, oh, I'm really drawn to that thing that you have there. And so they come, and they're embraced, but they don't want to do what's necessary in order to enjoy that level of intimacy that we have, which is putting yourself out there, being honest, bringing your whole self to the table. And those people usually, they leave, they move on, which is okay. We're not the church for everybody. But I think that's what happens with relationships a lot. People will see a good relationship, like, they'll see a married couple or a couple that seems to have a satisfying, and they're like, I want that too, but they're not willing to do the work that gets that for them, and they give up. Does that make sense? So that's why I just try to be real. It's terrible to say marriage is an ordeal, it's a crucible of selfhood. On one level, I love being married, but there are times when, you roll over and you're like, who are you and how did you get in my bed? How did I get here 20 years later? And then you sort of work back. Like I said, 7 years ago with my husband, it was a really hard time. And if somebody had told me the day before things broke, you don't have a good marriage, I would have been like, you're crazy. Because I was on autopilot, sort of. Just taking care of everybody except my marriage. So there are moments of real, real difficulty. But it's so worth it to get through, right, Matt? You know a little bit about what I'm talking about, right? And you're in the 7-year itch. The 7-year itch year, they say the 7-year itch. Apparently, though, I read that it's been reduced to the 2-year trouble or something now because people are speeding things up so fast, that after 2 or 3 years, you're kind of like, ugh, what a mistake this was. Good questions. Thank you.
Thanks again.
You're welcome.